Welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. This is a podcast run by artists for artists where we talk about what it means to be one. I'm Tun Miai, the producer, with our host Dina Brodsky and Marshall Jones. This is being recorded between our many jobs and side hustles. We bring you in-depth investigations into the lives of artists we admire and the stories behind the creative journey. So stay on the grind while we fill your mind.
Hi everyone. So before we get started today, I'd like to say a big thank you to the Professional Artists Institute for sponsoring this episode of Art Grind. Their mission is to help artists make a living from their work and basically survive and thrive as an artist so that we don't all have to work multiple jobs in order to support our passion. So if you're anything like me and prefer to spend time in your studio making art rather than marketing your work and kind of concentrating on the business side of things, then check out some of their free trainings at professionalartist.com-free and get a free training on how to get your next art collector. I promise that you will like it and it will help because it helps me. All right, bye everyone. Enjoy the episode.
All right, welcome everyone to the Art Grind Podcast. I'm Marshall Jones here with my co-host Dina Brodsky. And today we have an interview that I'm very excited about. A great artist. He is an icon carver, carves in wood. And he's also a philosopher and a sort of a religious scholar. Someone that I've listened to a lot of their content, Jonathan Pagiot. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. This is great. It's not the usual kind of thing that I participate with, so I'm really excited to see how this is going to go and where it's going to go.
Well, we can't wait to talk about your art and life. So
wait. But before we start at that, what is the usual kind of things that you participate in? Describe.
Well, I say most of the time now, people interview me because I talk about symbolism and kind of symbolic structures in stories and narrative, in images as well, and that seems to be. It's becoming the thing people know me most about, and most of my online content is about that. So it's not that often that I talk with artists about art. It's happened recently for some funny reason. It's happened a bit more. I was invited to Princeton and did an event there that was really about art and a few other places. So maybe, yeah. So, but I think it's great. I'm excited to talk about it.
Well, we actually put you on. Not you. We made a post on Instagram. Who would you like us to interview to our audience? And you came up a couple of times and it was like, that would be a lot of fun.
That's funny.
Actually, Jonathan, to be like, you know, fully transparent about this, it wasn't that post. It was, you know, something that was that we did that got a mildly controversial reaction. And one of the comments was, they should interview Jonathan Pagiot. He would really like set you guys straight. And I was like, who is this guy? I want to talk to this person who's apparently supposed to set us straight.
Okay, but what is the controversial
thing? They think we're part of the woke mind virus that I hear about.
Oh, okay. Are you? I don't know. Like, what? I'd have no idea. I don't know much about you, so...
No, we're just people.
Yeah, exactly. I hope so. You seem like people. You don't seem like viruses to me. You seem like human beings in the flesh. So that's good. That's good.
Marshall, did you just call it the woke mind virus?
I'm hearing that phrase all the time.
You heard that. All right. Yeah.
The woke mind virus.
That is the least politically correct thing I've ever heard you say. But then, I don't know, say it again. Woke mind virus. We will try not to be viruses, but I think so Marshall knew who you were kind of to begin with, and then I got really interested basically after that comment. I was like, I want to listen to this guy, and then we're like, all right, he's really interesting, I wonder if he'd say yes. So thank you so much for being here.
All right, this is great.
So where did it all start for you? How did you get interested in art, I guess, primarily, and then we can move to the wood carving. Where did your interest in art start from?
So, I mean, when I was young, I was really interested in drawing. I love to draw. I would draw every day. And so from a very young age, I was pretty sure that I was going to become an artist of some capacity. You know, like many teenagers, I was interested in comic books and illustration. And so I thought maybe I would go down that direction. But ultimately, when I ended up in college, and here we have like a college system and then university. And then in university, you know, I was studying studio art, and it was mostly gallery type art and working learning about the history of art and feeling very excited about that, about art movement and everything. That's what I was studying. So I ended up at Concordia University in painting and drawing. And but it was difficult for me. It was difficult in many ways. One was that I was a Christian, and there's something about postmodernism which is very cynical. Or ironic, you could say. There's like ironies upon ironies in much of the work that appears still today, right? If you look at many of the gallery pieces, there's kind of these levels of irony that it exists in. And it's also so rooted in a very hermetic language of art that you kind of have to be initiated into. And it's very difficult for, you know, your mom and pop type person to appreciate gallery art. So because of that, I struggled, because I wanted to make direct things. I wanted to make real things. I didn't want to make something which was a comment on something. I didn't want to make something which was like some very subtle, elaborate, play on something else. But I was really struggling to find a language to do that. That was one of my problems. The other problems was that I was a Protestant. I was a Baptist. And in the Baptist tradition, there's not an explicit, hatred of visual art, but there's like an implicit thing, a kind of just implicit culture that visual art and visual images are suspicious, let's say, at least at the highest level, right? At least theologically, there's no defense for them, right? We kind of know they exist, and it's fine that they exist, but we don't understand their role in the world, and we don't understand how they participate in the life of people in a deep way, you could say. So all of that, I would say, led me to a crisis. When I finished school, it was so weird. I finished first in my program, and so I was pretty happy. But then my last evaluation, the professor that was kind of guiding us, she sat me down, and really just before graduation, she said, "What are you doing here?" She said, you should go to seminary or something. Like, you just don't belong here. And I was 20 something years old. I was just rolled off my back, but she was right. Ultimately, she was totally right. And so I did the thing. I rented a studio and started making really ambitious, the kind of ambitious stuff you make when you're in your 20s, like these huge, and it was the 90s still. So these massive, huge paintings and like collages and these things that were completely insane.
Was it like representational, though? Was that what you were doing in school, like painting from the figure, from the live model, or what?
No, I was reading a lot of postmodern theory. And what I was trying to do in some ways was to create a kind of symbolic language, but I didn't have the grammar really to do it. And so I was influenced quite a bit by people like Anselm Kiefer, who was quite popular at the time, and a few artists like that that were trying to reintroduce, let's say, mythological imagery in a subtle, in a very sophisticated way into their painting, but were also introducing matter as symbol, you could say, you know, kind of following Joseph Beuys, this idea that it's like found object but into the painting. So if you add certain materials into the painting, it participates in the symbolism of the painting. So I was really interested in that type of stuff. And I was trying to create a kind of language where I would use different styles of art in the modern times to represent certain things. And then I created these kind of collage images that would have some constructivism in it, and then some kind of, expressionism in it, and trying to create this kind of language. It ended up turning into like massive collages of paper, where I would draw and I would rip things off and kind of re-glue them. Anyways, it looked very postmodern, but there was something that was there's maybe too deliberate about it, and just wasn't. I mean, obviously, thinking back, it wasn't successful. Like my professor was right. Like, I had all the effort, I had all the thinking, but it just wasn't the right medium for what I was trying to do. Contemporary art just wasn't the right thing for me. It just didn't work because I was trying, like I said, to make something, use irony and use this kind of quote culture where I was quoting different styles and different references. But in order to create something real, like to create something that is actually participating in people's lives. But like I said, I don't think that it was ultimately successful. But all of that kind of led me to a spiritual crisis in general in my 20s, like most people have, I guess a lot of people have that. And I ended up just quitting art completely. I destroyed all my paintings. And I just thought, okay, I'm just going to have a regular life. I'll have a job, whatever, you know, just be a regular guy. I was married at the time. My wife thought it was hilarious that I would even propose that. She's like, she knew that that wasn't going to last. And then I also ended up going on a kind of spiritual search, which led me towards more mystical forms of Christianity, ultimately to Orthodoxy. And so I converted to Eastern Orthodoxy, but I also discovered medieval language of art. I discovered kind of this language that had been developed in the first millennia of the Christian story, which was this powerful traditional language of signs and of tropes, you could say. And these tropes were kind of like rhymes. You could think of it that way. There were rhymes that would find themselves in different paintings. And so what I realized is that there's like a language where the images are talking to each other. And so you can see that they are, it's almost like they're rhyming with each other. And that was based also on kind of typology, let's say biblical typology. So the images you find in the Bible would end up in visual images, end up work like a kind of poem or kind of algebra. I don't know how else to say it, kind of visual algebra, you could say. And I really fell in love with that. I just thought it was amazing. And in some ways it was what I was looking for. You know, it was something that I had been looking for all this time in contemporary art, but just wasn't able to make it work. Because one of the things about this language is that it was really integrated in people's lives. It wasn't like something you go to the gallery to see, or someone investor buys it and puts it in a warehouse somewhere waiting for the price to go up, right? It was none of that. Like it was something, you know, you go to church and you see this image and it's like your patron saint. It's like, it's your story. It's the story of your people. It's the story of your, of the things that you find important and that you celebrate. So I really just fell in love with that. Let's say community celebratory, powerful language. And but I felt, sorry, go ahead.
Do you not see that sort of thing? Like in the work of like Anselm Kiefer or something, do you see it?
That's right. So you could see why I like Kiefer so much, because Kiefer had some of that. Now, okay. the problem with Kiefer, it's a deeper problem. It's like, it's the problem of art itself, which is that the problem with Kiefer is the gallery space itself. Like the gallery space is like this aseptized space of alienated experience, right? So you go to a gallery to look at paintings. That is not, how can I say this? That is not a normal thing to do. Mm-hmm. We were not used to thinking that way, but it's the same. Like we're not, the idea of sitting down and listening to music or going to a gallery to look, there's nothing wrong with it, but it is a very strange, isolated, alienated thing. Whereas let's say more traditionally, images would have been, like I said, in the church, it would have been in the public square. They would have been in the king's castle. They would have been something that just participated in a larger language of architecture, of music, of poetry, and all of this would flow together, right? And so that is what I was kind of hoping for. And I can see that in Kiefer's work that he was in some ways trying to break through. I mean, still, he's still alive. He's trying to like break through. But I'm not sure that it ends up being a kind of bitter sweetness that's in his work. There's a kind of sadness because he's stuck in the frame of the gallery space. And so he's always kind of exploring decadence. Like he's always exploring death. That's his motif. It's like death and the hope maybe of rebirth. And like this little tiny glimmer, you know, it's a successful piece at the Louvre. I saw it like a month ago. I was in Paris. I didn't know that he had a piece there. And, you know, and you can see that, you know, it's like these books with a sunflower and the sunflower is dead. But then there are seeds of the sunflower that are falling back on the books, and just a few of those seeds are gilded. And it's like, in some ways, it's almost obvious. It's not that subtle in terms of art. But you know, that's as much as Kiefer can do. Like that hope that a new form of participation and art can be born.
These subjects really interest me because I wonder, like, it feels, I mean, maybe what you're saying is the context, like the commercial context of art galleries. Like it's almost like going into a shoe store, you know, certain ones sell certain types of shoes. And maybe there's something blasphemous about that. But then I also think, like, when some churches you go to and they've been, you know, like some paintings on the wall to illustrate a story of out of the Bible, you know, and they're not particularly well done. I'm thinking about some churches I've been in, and that doesn't seem particularly elevated in terms of Kiefer as well, you know?
Yeah, I agree. But so you could say there's a trade-off. Like, there's a trade-off between participation and high art, let's say. And that's a real thing, right? It's an actual problem. But in some ways, if we understand it in terms of hierarchy, that's probably the best way to think about it, which is the language that I kind of fell in love with and that I engaged with, that, you know, that I became a carver, like an icon maker, someone who makes images in this traditional language, was that the models, the high models are there, right? You imagine, like, in the medieval time, you had the cathedral, and in the cathedral, you would have had the best version of that. And then you know what it is. Everybody knows that that's the best version. And then somewhere in some little village church, then you've got the folk version of that, which is down much lower on the scale of quality. And everybody also knows that. Everybody knows that the church in my village, it's okay, it's fine. You know, I'm happy to go there and it's okay, but it's obviously not. It's not Constantinople. It's not Paris. It's not Saint-Chapelle or whatever. It's not these churches that are in ways models for the other. So it's a different way of understanding. The problem also with a lot of these modern, a lot of the modern churches and the modern art that's in churches, the kind of thing you're saying, is that there's people have forgotten the language. They just kind of improvise, and it ends up being mediocre. One of the things about typology, or let's say a more formal language, is that in the formal language, there's a way to prevent the really bad stuff too, right? Because there's a type of formality which is created by the tradition, which makes it that you can't just do whatever you want. You also have to kind of, you know, it's almost ceremonial in the way that you make those images. You have to make it in a way that will be recognized by people that that's what you're doing. And so there's the kind of dance with tradition that you're doing.
So how does that manifest? Like, is that like a canon of proportion you're using, like certain links and things, or how does that actually play out?
So there are definitely different aspects to it. One is the iconology itself. That is, if you're making, let's say, an image of a certain event, then there are certain things that have to be there that are just part of the tradition. They've just been handed down. You have to learn it. You have to assimilate it. You have to kind of get to know what the language of the tradition is. And so you will want to represent it in that form. So it doesn't have to be copies of anything, but let's say you know that if I'm going to make an image of the Nativity of Christ, let's say in an Eastern style, like in an Eastern Orthodox icon, then I know that it's in a cave. I know that it has an ox and an ass. I know that Christ is wrapped in you know, there are different elements, and I've seen enough images that I know how to make it so that people will recognize it as being theirs. They'll recognize it as being, just like you recognize a pop song from jazz, just like you recognize, you know, hip hop from heavy metal. There are tropes that you can know and you can recognize. So there's the iconology. There's a way of representing the form. You know, you tend to represent things frontally with the faces visible. We tend to, you know, represent almost like a diorama, like a kind of that type of representation, in order to make it kind of clear and there's a really direct perspective with the sky above, the earth below. There are different tropes that you kind of have to learn. And then there are ways, but it's more flexible, like how to represent clothing, how to represent different gestures and all that stuff. And some codes, like, you know, halos and different things that we know what people kind of know what they mean within the tradition.
So when you said that you had like a crisis of faith in your 20s, how deep did that go?
I mean, I let's say I started reading I started reading. It was mostly reading. I was reading and reading and reading, you know, and reading weird stuff. And, you know, everybody in their 20s reads kind of esoteric stuff. And, you know, and so reading things from other tradition, reading Gnostic texts, reading, you know, Sufi texts and Hindu texts or whatever, just trying to get a sense of what is this thing. You know, it's like you kind of grew up in faith. But I always knew that I was a Christian. I just kind of couldn't get out of that. I knew that that was what I was. And then when I discovered, let's say, the liturgical language, this kind of what I saw as a very powerful participative dance that you can engage with in the liturgy and the art and the architecture, and then also discovering certain mystical texts from the Church Fathers, then that really just convinced me that, wow, okay, so it is here. Like, there is a kind of non-dual mystical version of Christianity, and it's just that it's here. You know, it's like I just have to go in that direction and access it.
And do you remember how that discovery began for you? Like, did you ever want to be a gallery artist? And then there was a moment of disillusionment, or was it like basically, what was the beginning of the direction that you took?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really, I guess, when I went to college, I started to study art history and became excited about art history, became excited about modern and contemporary artists. And so there was a kind of excitement to be able to participate in that. You know, especially it was a weird transition where I was, because most of the people, the college where I went, they had very little knowledge of what was happening in contemporary art. They were kind of stuck in, like, I don't know, the 60s or something. And the 60s in terms of like formal painting, right? Like late modernism, really. And so for them, like, contemporary art was like Jackson Pollock, like that was contemporary art, right? So there was a sense in which being in school and learning that, and then all of a sudden on your own with your friends, discovering that there's this whole other world that no one's telling you about. And this whole, and it was like this excitement about discovering these new artists and these different art movements, and the, you know, especially in the 90s, there was still like all that whole neo-expressionist movement, and, you know, all these young painters in from London that were, I mean, they're still famous now. So there's that kind of exploding excitement, and maybe the possibility of painting, you know, in that kind of exploded style, exploded way. Mm-hmm. So there was a kind of excitement that we could participate in that. And that at least was my kind of excitement. And then when I did, like I said, when I discovered Kiefer, I really saw that he was offering offering me like a way out, a way to do art in a way that was had more meaning in it, that it was more mythological and had all these illusions that really attracted me. And so that was that. But then I think that I ran into the problem of art itself. And so one of the things that helped was reading a small little book that you might know called Christian and Oriental Art by Ananda Kumaraswamy. Kumaraswamy was one of the curators at the Boston Museum in the 20s. He was friends with Stieglitz and was hanging out with all those kind of modernists. But Kumaraswamy tried to help people understand the traditional vision of art. And so he tried to help people see that the ancients, even in the Middle Ages, he would say things like, art stays in the artist, right? Art is a skill. That's what art is, you know? So that's why we say, right, the art of rhetoric or the art of winemaking or whatever. And so the art stays in the artist, and the artist creates artifacts, but the art is the skill that the artist has gathered, right? And the word art means to properly join together, right? That's what the word art means. It means to properly fit things together. And the idea is that the artist uses his skill to properly fit things together in service of a purpose, in service of a patron. So that's the way to understand it. And so someone asks you to make a chair, and then you take the elements and you fit them properly together in order to fulfill the purpose that you are accomplishing. So it's a very different perception of art, because all of a sudden it's like, art doesn't have value in itself. And that is something that once it broke in my mind, there was no turning back. Because one of the problems that you have with a lot of contemporary art is that people are always arguing whether it's art or not. Like, is this art? Isn't it art? As if art has some magical value in itself, as if art is something that we should care about. It's like, no, I don't care about art. Yeah, not in that way. I have no care. It's like the art, what is it doing? Like, what is it doing? If you can help me see what it's doing and I can get engaged in what it's doing, then I can care again. And so that's why it reframed my entire perception of art, which is that if I make images, I want them to be artful in every way. That is, I want them to hit the mark, to aim at a purpose. And that purpose has to have different levels. It has to be visually successful. It has to be, you know, it has to be beautiful, visually successful. It's something that has to last because someone's paying for it. Like, it has to have a certain amount of solidity, but it also has to be integrated into people's lives. And so for me, like, making an icon that will go into a church, that's amazing. That means that thing will, like, people will come and, like, be baptized and get married, and people will, and it'll be like in their life, it'll be some part of their celebration. And so to me, that is a very, very precious thing. Like, I can tell you a little story that can help you understand this. You know, when I was figuring out becoming an icon carver, my bishop, you know, he saw that I was fiddling with this, and he kind of saw that I was doing these carvings, and he said, why don't you make a panagia for me? It's like a little carving that you wear, that he will wear in his, like, in his vestment. So he'll have, like, a chain and have this little image of Mary and Jesus, you know, the Mother of God and Christ on this thing. And I thought, okay, I'm gonna do this. It was my first commission. I'd never done anything for anybody. And so I worked really hard and I made this thing, and I spent like 3 days just slaving on it, trying to figure out how to do it. And then I brought it to him. I wrapped it up in a little piece of paper, and you know, he was there on a Sunday, my bishop, and I gave him the piece. And all I was thinking about was, was I successful? Did I do it well? You know, whatever. And he opened it. And when he saw it, he bowed and he crossed himself. And I thought, that's it. Like, for me, there was no turning back. You know, I mean, Picasso can sell his paintings for like hundreds of millions of dollars, but nobody kisses them. Like, nobody bows in front of them. And the only thing I have to give up is the credit. If I give up the credit, if I say that it's not me, it's the image, it's the person represented in the image, which is causing that in my bishop. It's not my doing. If I give up that, then I have access to this whole world of participation. And for me, it was worth it. The trade was like, there was no question. The trade was definitely worth it.
Hmm. And do you think these two things are mutually exclusive? Like, do you think there's kind of no room for your name, you know, like, do you think there's no room for your name there?
No, I mean, ultimately that will happen. Like, ultimately, if you do things well, then people will know that you made them. And I think that's fine, but that's definitely not the purpose, because, it changes, because in some ways I'm not, one of the most freeing things in my life was to realize that I don't have to express myself. It's like, it was one of the most liberating moments that I've ever had. And when I realized, actually, you know what I want to express? I want to express something more than myself. I want to express, you know, I want to express people's participation in this powerful story. I want to express, you know, something that is spiritual. I want to participate in that. And it doesn't mean that I won't be expressing myself. It'll happen. Because you can't avoid it. Whatever you do, you're going to be part of it. But it's not the goal. It's very low on the hierarchy of what I'm trying to do.
So tell us what your hierarchy is, because I come from many generations of atheists, right? But we're all kind of atheists who are a little jealous of religious people, because religion obviously gives you all these things, right, that we're cognizant of missing out on. But yet it's just, you know, like, my father's an atheist, my mother's an atheist, my grandparents were atheists.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a long lineage of people who don't do that stuff, right? Yeah. So whenever I meet a religious person, I get really excited, right? it's like, oh my God, can we just talk about Adam and Eve? Because, I, you know, there's no one else to do this with.
If you want to figure that out, figure out Adam and Eve.
Adam and Eve, I actually do talk about with my, you know, family. Well, we've had a long standing debate about this. But that being said, what is your hierarchy art-wise?
Yeah, so the idea is, you know, and for atheists that are listening, this might be difficult. I'm going to try to frame it in a way that an atheist could understand, okay? And so when we make things, we are, you could say, celebratory creatures. We are creatures that celebrate. And the way to understand that, it has to do with attention, right? For something to merit our attention and for us to put our attention on something deliberately is in some ways a small version of celebrating, okay? Did you understand what I mean? It's like if I care about something and I attend to it, what I'm doing in some ways is celebrating the thing, that thing, okay, a little bit. And so you can understand that this is something that especially culture is about. And so if we, you know, if we go see a show and we watch, what do? We clap. Why do we clap? Like, right, because this thing that gathers our attention, you know, the fact that we're willing to give it is already a celebration, like I said. And so we clap and we say hooray and hurrah, and we give awards to people who make movies, and we celebrate this thing. Now, so the question then becomes, what is it that we should be celebrating? And so that is the question that I'm asking. That is a question that brought me in some ways where I am. Hmm. If cultural acts are celebratory by their nature. And so the thing is that there are other types of cultural acts. You could say there are something like questioning cultural acts. And those are the ones that are the most popular today. And so most of what we consider to be culture is actually something that tries to not celebrate. It tries to question. We question the system. We question our perception. And so we love the cubists because they question the way we perceive things. We love the abstract expressionists because they question the very limits of what a painting can be. We love Duchamp because he questions what art is, right? So we have this idea that questioning, right, that's culture. So everything about hippies, rock and roll, all that stuff, it's all questioning. But then there ends up being like a ridiculous moment when you have like, you know, these massive museums that are cost hundreds and millions, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, with artworks in them that are worth hundreds of millions of dollars as well. And we build these massive like temples to these works that are supposed to question the structures. It's like, what is going on? Why are we worshiping, like celebrating things that question the structure? It's like, it's like a performative contradiction, right? It's like we'll give awards to artists that are the most rebellious. We'll celebrate people that are the most rebellious. It creates a weird kind of contradictory situation in which we are. And so what I wanted to do was to find a way to celebrate that which is the most important, to do it in a way that is coherent with what celebration is. And you could say that scales all the way up to the origin of everything. Right, that scales all the way up to the very origin of what makes us know what is good, and you know, and for a Christian, for a religious person, that's God. And so, the highest aspect of the hierarchy is something that you do, which is in service or celebrates the highest. That celebrates God.
But doesn't questioning do the same thing?
No, I know what he's saying, right? I feel like culture has been about, I mean, maybe it's just the 20th century. It's been about questioning, but it's also been about how many boundaries can we break,
yeah, right? Well, that's what breaking boundaries are. Breaking boundaries is questioning. It's saying, how necessary is this?
And then how necessary is the next one, and how necessary is the one after that? But what happens, there isn't really an infinite number of boundaries to break. Right.
Visual art, we know that because it basically, I'm always joking about this, but it's like there's nothing new after 1920, really, or maybe 1925. Like after 1925, it's all repetition. Like everything that comes after until today, there's nothing new. It's all just a weird ritual repetition of the Dada or the Surrealists or, you know, all the artists that were there right there. It's like you could, anything that you see in a gallery today, you know, and in terms of what it's attempting to do, you'll find it in Dada probably. Like it's all kind of there. So that's the problem too. It's like, what are we doing when we have this idea that we're going to question everything, and then we repeat the action of questioning. And then we do that. How are we going to do that indefinitely? Like, are we going to keep doing that? When does that run out?
I mean, I agree that there's a limited number of boundaries to break. I don't agree that we've broken them all by 1920, but like 1955. Now, you know what it is? It's more like exciting breaking boundaries, you know, what's happening through maybe like 60s, 70s, 80s. And at some point by the 90s, it's like, it felt like boundaries weren't being broken to question. I think the questions are, you know, they're good, they're interesting, right? But I felt like boundaries were being broken just to see if there's another one. And it kind of felt fake and forced, right? Whereas what you're talking about celebrating is kind of, it taps into a different channel. Yeah.
So that's you could say that's my hierarchy, is to understand that the things that build are the things that I want to be part of. And the question, but what is the most important to build? Because you could build things that are parasitic. You can build things that are off, right? And so you can imagine that there are cultures of celebrating that we see, for example, professional sports. They have a whole reality of celebration, right? They have everything about what they have colors and songs and dance, and all of this is almost like, it's almost like a church service, but in the purpose of celebrating something, which is, you know, excellence in physical activity. And that's fine. Like that's okay. But I want to participate in the highest, like that's what interests me. And so the idea of making something in the service of God and in the service of community, something that is, like I said, is actually part of someone's baptism and wedding and funeral, something that is part of all those moments that bring us together, that kind of, you know, it's like, imagine like I make a family icon and they have it there, and, you know, they sit around the table and they eat and they have their family icon in the room. It's like I'm participating in you could say identity formation, like I'm participating in communion. And so to me, that is a very, and I'm doing it in a way that's not, hopefully that's not utilitarian, right? That's not weaponized. Like, cause you can do that by just creating logos. Like if you create logos for company, you're kind of doing that, but there's nothing wrong with that, but it's lower on my hierarchy, you could say, when you're making, you know, let's say you're working on an advertising campaign and you're trying to get people to like your product or like or participate in this or that campaign or whatever. These things are all celebratory too. They're just, in my opinion, lower on the scale. And so that's, yeah, sorry. Go ahead, Marshall.
I have a question that, because I like what you're saying, like pointing to higher things. And I think your work reflects a lot of that. And I enjoy looking at it, but I wonder if it's reductive to what other people are doing in more secular spaces. Like, I don't know. I think about, that old song, "Why Does the Devil Have All the Good Music?" Remember that? Like Stripe or whatever. And it's like, I hear what you're saying and I see it working in your life, but then on a mass scale, when I think of particularly Christian art, I think of, I don't know, Left Behind movies and VeggieTales and Third Day. And these are not, they're doing things with the motivation you're talking about, but it would be hard to say that this is,
it's horrible. Yeah, I totally agree.
Where does it exist?
It's horrible because it's utilitarian. Obviously utilitarian art is always tends to move on the lower spheres, right? It's like, it's not celebratory. Those movies like Left Behind, they're not celebratory. They're literally propaganda. It's like propaganda is a form of participation, which is quite low. It's not like it shouldn't exist. You know, we, you know, advertisement is, it's at the level of advertisement, right? It's basically movies like Left Behind or VeggieTales are just there for you to believe in Jesus. Like, that's what they want. They want you to, you know, to do the thing. Like, they, it's a form of advertisement. What I'm talking about is there a difference between celebration and this kind of propaganda?
But where is the cell? Like, who are some artists doing what you're talking about?
I think that let's say if we take secular art, there are people that I think are coming close to it, even in the Christian world. Like, you know, if you've seen Secret Life, you know, that's a very, very powerful Christian movie. A Hidden Life by Malick, Terrence Malick. Like, it's a very powerful story that helps you kind of glimpse into the life of someone who's trying to live the ideal, let's say. You know, Tarkovsky had some very powerful films. You know, his movie Rublev is an example. If you think of people like Dostoevsky, these are not propagandists, you know. Like, Dostoevsky is not a propagandist. Dostoevsky is a powerful, you know, dive into human relations, human psyche. And so there are ways, even in, so I'm not, like, I want to be clear, I'm not discounting secular art. Like, I'm not, because Dina asked me what my hierarchy is. I'm telling you what my hierarchy is. But I, even myself, you know, I'm totally fine. I'm going to publish a series of fairy tales next month. I'm publishing Snow White, and then we're going to do 8 fairy tales. I published a graphic novel last year, and so I'm totally fine with even popular art or secular art or gallery art. All these are fine, but I do think that in some ways they end up being lower on the hierarchy, you could say, and that the highest thing that art can do is serve the eternal, right? Serve and celebrate the source of goodness itself. And that downstream from that, then there can be all kinds of arts, but it's like a kind of anchor. So think about it, like, that's how it was in the Middle Ages, right? Think about, you go to a city, where's the place where you can see the most beautiful things? You go to church, and then in the church, it's a public space. You can go there, and then there's beautiful paintings, there's beautiful music, there's beautiful architecture. You know, all the let's say the chairs and the cups, everything is made the most pristine. And so what it happens is it becomes a kind of model of excellence. And then there'll be different iterations of these things lower in the village. So it's like Gothic architecture isn't just church architecture. It turns out that you can use it for secular buildings. People end up using it even for their houses or whatever, but the pristine version, the place where it served its highest purpose, is in the church architecture.
I guess it's like, it just feels reductive to me to say that if you're not creating art to point to God, then it's not as high. That doesn't strike me as true.
You don't like that?
I like it. I like the conversation for sure. It just seems like there's no evidence for it in the real world, and it doesn't strike me as true.
Hold on, Marshall, are you actually disagreeing with someone? I thought you were way too non-confrontational for that.
It's good. Now I must be poking at the right thing.
Because, like, if I think about, you know, you could rattle off so many great Christian artists, so many great secular artists, so many great atheist artists, and their aims are, to me, human expression, which maybe, I mean, I would consider that pretty high. I wouldn't say it's the highest of all things, but that is something really beautiful. And I hate to reduce people doing it for those motivations.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's not a reduction. I think it's important to understand that I was asked what is the highest. And so I express what is the highest, but I still have a deep admiration for art that isn't serving that purpose. I actually, you know what? I even have a deep admiration for the questioning art. I think that I think that you could say that we've reached a kind of excellence in questioning in the 20th century that we had never seen before. And so there's a kind of power. I was at the MoMA just like 2 weeks ago, and you know, there's some powerful things there that are difficult to deny in terms of the capacity to present something that is both coherent in its presentation to you, but also clearly is there to poke at your perception of reality. So I think that's fine, but it's like the fact that I like jesters doesn't mean that I want to put a crown on the jester. Like, it's fine that there be jesters, but the king is right. The jester's there to make fun of the king, but without the king, there's no gesture. So the breaking of the boundaries is there to break boundaries, but without the boundaries, there's no breaking. So we need to know which one comes first, you could say, and then which one plays with it afterwards.
Okay, so the thing at the top of your hierarchy, right? The kind of communion with God.
Dina was asking if it is possible that things that are not religious can have that kind of transcendent possibility in them, right? That if you attend to something like a tree or an apple or something, and you do it properly, that it could in some ways be a divine revelation. And I think the answer is yes, of course. You know, it's like all that exists is a possible theophany, right? All that God has created is a place for a possible revelation or a possible connection with that which transcends it. That is absolutely true. The reason why the religious is particular in this case is that it's not, how can I say this? It's a scaled version of that. So it's like, it's not just me and in my heart, let's say, because you could also find that in yourself, like in your own heart, you can find a ladder to heaven. You know, that's what Saint Ephrem the Syrian says. But what religion does is that it scales that to participation with others. And so it's like, if you see God in the apple, like maybe a chance that your friend will see that too. Maybe less, maybe not. But if we're together and now we celebrate something that we both recognize as being a revelation, then that will help us, that will make us it into a dance now. Now we're together and we're looking at something which is beyond. And so that's what religious ritual is for. And so we're together and we have something. We have things that we sing about, things that we all recognize as for sure being a place of revelation.
I mean, I feel like you're a believer. What does belief in God feel like internally? Like, what is it like to believe? We can edit this out. This is
okay. That's fine with me. What does it feel like? Okay, so let me ask you something. Like, do you believe in the United States?
I mean, do I believe that it exists and it's a reasonable thing?
Yeah. But you can't capture it, or you can't touch the United States. You can't taste it. You can't put it in your hand. Like, you can't see it at a glance, right?
I mean, it's a concrete whatever. It's a country. It has borders. But I see what you're getting at.
And so the idea, but then you could try to scale that up, right? And so you can't see, let's say, generosity. You can only see acts of generosity, but then you kind of see through those. You see, like, there's something binding this stuff together. Right? It's like, why do I recognize the same thing across different types of behaviors? And so you can kind of see something kind of pop up above it. It's like, oh, I can see that all these acts have something in common, and that thing in common seems to have qualities. It's like, oh, it's a virtue. It's something that is above, right? It's an angel. It's something that is acting through us, right? And so you can kind of see that. And you think that that's good. You're like, wow, every time you see acts of generosity, you're like, oh, I recognize that. That's beautiful. I think that's wonderful. Like, isn't that great? And that's what it feels like. But imagine you keep scaling that up from the little ones, like from like little things that you kind of see pop up above phenomena and kind of binding them together. If you keep going up, then you reach at something like the source of all things, the source of all the good. And that's what it feels like to believe in God.
Is that like Plato's good? Like, Like
Plato comes really close, for sure. I mean, I think there's a reason why the Christians definitely use a lot of Plato's language, because the transcendentals are very close to the way that I would say most people understand God to be. So it's close. But the difference, I would say, with between Plato and, let's say, a Christian God is that we see that these patterns have agency. That we see it as mirroring in our agency. So it's different. It's not an abstract thing. It's like you realize that, like if you use the idea of virtues, it's like when we embody the virtues, we realize that it's a kind of agency that we participate in that has coherence and kind of acts on us or acts through us, you could say. Go ahead.
How concrete is the God that you believe in? You know, honestly, maybe these are just questions that I've always wanted to ask a believer. But how concrete is that God? Is it, you know, do you think of it, him, whatever, as a concrete being? Is it more of an abstract concept? Just talk to me.
Yeah, it's not a being. God is not a being. So God is the source of being, you could say, the ground of being, the source of being. And so you could say, as much as you could say that God exists, you could say that God does not exist. Like you could say both. And some of the church fathers have gone that far to say both, because God is the source of all being. Now, the idea that you can help you understand this is that the only, as conscious, intelligent beings, we see that reflected in us. We see something of transcendence reflected in us. And so that is, let's say, so the best image for God is a person. Or in Christian terms, we say it's a communion of persons. Like that's the best image of God you're going to get, is the idea that God is a communion of persons, one and many, that God is both, is love between three infinite persons. Like all these types of images, none of them are arbitrary. They're all there to kind of say, like, what's the source of all this, like, what's the source of all these things that we think are important and good? Yeah, hopefully that gives you but I have, like, I'm a Christian. I have a very clear, I have a very clear set of things that I believe also. I mean, I believe in the Holy Trinity. I believe in the incarnation of God in the person Jesus Christ. I'm a Christian. Like, I'm a real Christian. We could unpack all of those if you want. That might take a bit too much time, but ultimately, in terms of God, that would be the best way I could answer that question.
How does that belief, I know it's very deep in your art, the images you make, but how does that belief inspire you creatively?
I mean, it gives meaning, first of all, to what I'm doing. Like, I don't have those crises of meaning anymore. I don't ask myself, why am I doing this? It's like, I know why I'm doing this. I know why I'm doing it at a lower level. That is, I only work on commission, which is very powerful, because it's like, I'm making this for this person and I'm going to introduce it into their lives. But then ultimately I'm also making it in a direction that is pointing towards participating in the celebration of the infinite, you know? And so it's like, it anchors everything I do, right? It anchors my work. It anchors the reason why I'm doing it. It gives a direction to the things I'm doing.
That makes sense. Honestly, I'm culturally Jewish along with being atheist, and the Jewish God, as a Jewish God is, you don't really need to believe in him to remain culturally Jewish. It's more abstract, and there's not as clear of a, like, you're supposed to question everything, possibly including the existence of God. You know, one of the better explanations I've ever heard for, the existence of God was actually, it was at 4 a.m. in Jerusalem. And there was this rabbi I got into a conversation with, and it was one of these Jewish holidays where you're supposed to stay up all night. And this guy was telling me about a girlfriend he had before he met his wife. And, you know, the girlfriend was, you know, beautiful, and she was, you know, and he was deeply in love with her, and she just didn't believe in love.
like she was hurt too deeply, and you know, that was just not a thing that she believed in. And after a while, it ate into the relationship, because he kind of realized that in her universe, love doesn't exist. Like she's just living in a universe without it. And he said that to him, you know, like to him, living in a world without love would be really sad. Kind of like living in a world without God would also be really sad. And so he almost like, he's like, I just make the choice daily to believe, because that's the universe I want to live in. But it seems like for you, it's not a choice. Like you're just in it.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are moments, right, where you find it difficult, but I think at some point in my life, I realized, for example, like the idea, you know, as Christians, we say God is love. And so your example is particularly good to help you understand. And so at some point you realize that things need, at least for me, like things need transcendental something to bind. Like in order to bind multiplicity, you need something to be above it. There's no other way to do it. You need identities that are not contained in the details for something to be bound together. So it's like when you look at an image, none of the elements of the image make up the image. It's something, it's the communion of all the elements make the image appear. And that's one. You can say it's one image, but it's not one, it's a million things. And so once I realized that, I realized that that's actually how the world works. Everything scales up towards higher and higher goods. And so I can never doubt God anymore. You know, I can doubt sometimes. I can get angry. I can get annoyed because I feel like, you know, I wish this or that, or that I think that this or that injustice in the world, you know, is why is there this injustice, or why is it that there isn't, that there's still all these horrible things that if God is good, but I can't deny that that's just how reality lays itself out. So if I didn't believe in one God, I'd believe in many gods. Like, because at least that for sure, there's no doubt about it that there are gods. Like,
why are there all these horrible things? Right. So, you know, like, I guess the idea is that God made man in his own image, or, you know, or what you were saying earlier, that the closest you can get to God is man, because that's a bit of God is reflected in us. How about all the vastly unfair, terrible things that kind of happen? Where is God when all of that is happening?
So this is difficult, because obviously I don't want to make light of suffering, but I think the best way to see it is that it's an opportunity for us to become more. And so all the suffering is an opportunity for us to manifest the image of God more fully. And so when we see someone in pain and we love them, then we are making God real in the world, right? When we see a crisis, you know, if there's a crisis in your city, and I don't know, like some houses are burning down, and you help the people and you give them something and you take them in and you make, you know, you give them food, then you are making God real in the world. And so I know that might seem like a cop-out, because it's like, maybe those bad things shouldn't exist. Maybe everything should just be perfect. But it seems like that, say, the work of us being like God is not finished.
Well, okay.
And that has to find form. Like it has to play itself out.
Okay. So that person that is suffering, that maybe we love, right? Like, it could be our parent, it could be our child, right? So let's say for us, it's a learning moment. It's a way for us to learn how to help, to learn. But how about for them? Like, how about for the dying person that is just going to die? You know,
not just the person, all of us, every single one of us is going to die. I mean, it's all going to happen to us.
Yes. And I can actually see how religion would actually be extremely useful when that does happen.
Yeah.
Right. like, it seems like dying as a religious person would be kind of, you know, a much more, maybe like understand, maybe a softer experience, right? Yeah. Than you die in pain and there's nothing else out there. Yeah. Right. But meanwhile,
I said, I think it's difficult, because I don't want to make light of that but I will tell you what I've seen. What I've seen is when every time I've met people that have suffered greatly and have suffered, how can I say this? Have suffered well. I don't know what other word to use, that have suffered with the right intentionality and direction. Those people are radiant. Like they really are. It's a pretty astounding. When you meet someone who's battled cancer and has done it with a kind of, you know, and it has been transformed by it, or someone who is an alcoholic, or someone who, or whatever, like deep, deep difficulty or suffering they've had, and they've kind of worked through it in the right mode. They pop up. They become like, you can see them shining, like in the way that they are, and their deep, then their wisdom and the way that they. So I think that's like I said, that's maybe the best we can do in terms of seeing that. It's like, if when we suffer, it's in some ways a kind of opportunity. It's an opportunity for the real thing to emerge, right?
But do you believe in hell then?
If I believe in hell, yeah, I said all Christians believe in hell. I mean, I think at least some form of it, some form of hell. Yeah. Do you want me to? So Saint Ephrem the Syrian says that the fire of hell is the love of God. And so the idea is to understand that. So it's a good way actually to understand that. And so the difficulties in our life can make us bitter. And facing things that are hard and that don't go the way that you want can make you angry and bitter and resentful. And what they are actually are opportunities to let go of that, let go of your grasping. And so the idea is that hell, at least in my understanding and the most mystical Christian vision, hell is all of you, whatever you hold on to, as God is trying to make you into an image of himself, that's what's burning you.
I think the popular conception is hell is a fiery place that many people go, and few, by the Bible's own logic, you know, straight and narrow, and people beside you at the grocery store, your neighbor, odds are worse than 50-50 that they're going to hell and burning in conscious torment forever. I mean, that's hell.
Yeah, so the best way
you believe in.
But the best, most of the Orthodox saints, even recent saints, right? They'll say the best way to approach that is to think that you're going to hell and no one else is. That's probably the best way to go about that.
But the Bible says more than half are going to hell. So
that's not your problem.
It's a huge problem, though. I mean, fundamentally, when we're talking about it, it almost feels like if I was to have, you know, I invited you and Dina over for dinner, and I've got like all these puppies, and you're like, boy, he's really getting into these puppies, you know, that's great. And then I just have traps all over my house for puppies to fall into, to catch cancer, to get ran over by a car. I think at bare minimum, you'd be a little concerned of how I'm treating my puppies. You know, you wouldn't, bare minimum, we would say that's the most loving thing ever in the world. And then and the catch is more than half of these puppies are going to burn in hell at the end of it. I think you would have a hard time saying, well, he's really doing the right thing over there, and he's the most loving thing that ever existed. It seems like a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. Like, there is the story of the fall. The story of the fall plays a function in at least making sense of that, no matter how you understand it. And then there's also the idea that, how can I say this? Let's say that that's it. That's the breaks. So the reality of our life is that we do have suffering. The reality of our life is that we will see other people that we love suffer. And the question is, what's the best way to react to that? That's the question. Like, it's a very practical one. Is the best way to react to that to become bitter and angry at the world? Will that help them? Will that help us? If we grow in love, will that help them and help us? And the answer is yes. The answer is yes. And so if through suffering you learn to love, then you will be transforming the world into heaven. And if through suffering you learn to be bitter and hateful and resentful and sadistic, then you will be transforming the world into hell slowly. And so there's just a reality, which is like, I know it's annoying because we wish it wasn't like that, but there's just this reality about how of noticing how it is that who are the people that we admire? Who are the people that we see making great, great changes? Who are the people that we see that shine, that are beautiful examples of what it means to be human? And so I think that that's, to me, at least, like, how can I say this? As a very practical person, I see that, and I realize that that's right. That's it. It's not a philosophical question, right? It's a question of what do you do? Like, what do you? That's the question. What do we do now? Like, what do I do with my life? What do I do with the people around me? Like, where do I put my attention? How do I?
But that's not just a religious question though. That's one for all of us. Like what do I do? Like if this is the life we have, what do we do with it? Right. And I think for a religious person, maybe it's not the only life we have, but we still have to do something with this one. Yeah, you know, and in order to have a shot at a better one, we better do something good with this.
But if you want to understand also like the idea of life after death or whatever, or the idea of the eschatology or whatever, it's just a radicalization of your life now. It's just a mirror to see your life now in the extreme, like on steroids. That's what life after death is. And so it's not just like you die and go to heaven or whatever. It's an acceleration of what you are now. It's an accelerated mirror of what you're going through now. And so that's the best way to understand life after death. That's the best way to understand, you know, why it matters to imagine a moment in the future in which all the actions that I'm doing now will have their final fruits, in which all the love that I'm sowing now will come together in the end. And that's the best way to understand that in terms of why it would matter.
Would you act differently though? Like, let's say, you know, let's just say you were like me, or I was like you for that matter, right? I find God and I fully embrace that direction, or you all of a sudden, you know, lose God. Would that change how you lead your day-to-day life? Because I'm not sure it would change mine, right? Like, yeah. I think I would keep acting the same way, or I hope I would keep acting the same way. I hope I'm not leading like a, you know, really crappy life because, you know, would you act any differently?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. What I can see, and maybe this is the best way to see it, is that, like I said, religion is not just an individual thing. It's a binding agent, you could say. It's a way in which we bind together towards that which is the highest good. And so what I've seen is that as, let's say, Christianity wanes in the world, that we see increase in anxiety, increase in nihilism, increase in, you know, let's say fragmentation, maybe is a good word to use. And I can see that. Like, I can see that maybe you would act the same, but it seems like in general, things are fraying at the edges.
Do you think it's fraying at the edges because of the loss of religion? Or it's fraying at the edges for other reasons, like for, you know, globalization, like us being able to be anxious about something that's happening on the other side of the world just because we're going to know about it in real time. Because I don't know, actually. Like, you might be right. Like I think people tend to be less anxious when they know when there's less questioning.
Yeah. Sadly, I really have to go. I've kind of pushed myself beyond my time here. I appreciate, we ended up talking a lot more about other stuff besides art, but that's okay. I hope that's fine with you.
Jonathan, I feel like I have so many more things to ask you.
Great. Thanks, Jonathan.
I promise not to sidetrack so much next time.
Thanks so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode and you are a visual artist, you can help us keep costs of producing the Nyx podcast to zero by supporting our sponsor. Just go to professionalartist.com/free and access a free training on how to get your Nyx art collector. That's professionalartist.com/free. And that link will be in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and I hope you got some good painting done while we entertain you with our amazing guest. If you like what you're hearing, follow and subscribe to our podcast if you haven't done so yet. And if you're so inclined, rate us whether you love or hate us. We love hearing all the different opinions and appreciate the feedback. You can reach out to us at artgrindpodcast@gmail.com or DM us on IG at artgrindpodcast. You faithful listeners have the power to help us grow. So please spread the word. It's free and you'll feel good about it. So until next time, stay on the grind while we fill your mind.